This is the WGBH Forum Network.
Thank you, Pauline. Thank you, everyone, for participating with us today. We're really very excited to continue what we hope will be a very long tradition of celebrating Jazz Week at the Boston Public Library. And you all know Jazz Week, which runs through May 4th, means 185 different programs throughout the city, and we hope you'll go to all of them, if that in fact is physically possible. My duties today really are two. First, to make sure that you know if you're interested in learning more about jazz, excited about jazz, even if you think you know everything there is to know about jazz, the Boston Public Library and its 27 branches are a good place to visit, either online or in person, to learn more. Books, materials, recordings, even downloadable audio and video now that you can avail yourself of to learn more about it. So we welcome you doing that. Secondly, my very distinct honor this afternoon to introduce Dr. Emmett Price. It's always great to have some of these multi-talented people share with us, and Dr. Price is one of those, a professor, an author, a minister, a musician, and that's just the start of the list. He has a master's and doctorate in music from the University of Pittsburgh. He has performed in many, many venues around the world. He has written in many, many important journals, including the journals of liturgy and the journals of hip-hop and pop music. His authorship includes several books, including the major reference tool on hip-hop, and he's working on another work on hip-hop in the Black Church. He comes to us today to share, I think, his very special talent and insights, and to help us better understand a little bit more about several aspects of the music that we call jazz. So please today, I know it's a little chilly out, but please today put your hands together and give a very, very warm welcome to Emmett Price.
Good afternoon. All right, lesson number one is called call and response. I'm a call and you respond. Good afternoon. Oh, that's so much better. So much better. Privileged to be here. Thank you, Dr. Margolis, for a warm welcome to Pauline Bielski and the entire Jazz Boston family. Thank you for the invitation to come present on this afternoon. And thank you all of you who have given of your time at this noon hour when you could have been many other places doing a number of different things. I certainly appreciate your presence here. And we're going to have a good time. I'm just going to tell you that up front. Topic for today is From Jazz to Hip Hop and Beyond, and subtitle is Why Jazz Matters in the 21st Century. And it's a perplexing topic, and of course, anytime you match or put together jazz and hip hop in the same phrase, some would dare to say that I'm asking for trouble. But hopefully by the end of this time together, we will kind of see some signs and some significant interactions and concepts that are dual, if not parallel, in terms of hip-hop and jazz. So I have to first tell you that I'm a musician, and my sensibilities and my sensitivities come as a musician first, and then I'm certainly trained as a music scholar, but always say that's secondary, because if there was no music, there would be nothing to study. So as a musician, I kind of come from that position. And it's very important that I say that, because it'll help you to see some of the frameworks that I'm working with, and again, where my bias is. I got to put that up front. Second, in the education world, we're supposed to have learning objectives. So let me just be forefront about what the aims of today are. As brief as we have time, I have three objectives. One is to briefly explore the importance of music. And then two, to see how music can be a tool to help bridge the generational divide. And then three, certainly, how can jazz, or how has jazz been exemplary in achieving both number one and number two? And then the epilogue is, how does hip-hop fit in this? Right? Is that okay? All right, let's get ready to go. Can you imagine a day in your life without the presence of music? It's a difficult conception. I mean, you may say that you are not technologically advanced or savvy, and that perhaps you don't have an iPod or a CD player or a record player or an 8-track player or a reel-to-reel player, but music is all over the place. And you wake up in the morning and hear the birds sing. You even hear the cacophony of trucks and automobiles rolling down the street. Even some of us who are hearing impaired feel the vibrations of the rumbling as things occur in life. And all of these sonorities, timbres, and textures exemplify the fact that music exists, and you have to really, really, really work hard to get away from it. Then we understand that music has a power to make things happen in our lives. Many of us have a collection of music, and the collection is not necessarily based on fad or trend, or it may be, but it's based on what moves us at certain times, when we're in certain moods, when we're at certain places in our lives or going through certain things. So you may be at this place and this position, and you know for a fact you need to hear some of this, whether it's Bach, Beethoven, you know, whoever it is. Or you may be at a place in your life where you're going through something, you need to hear some B.B. King or some Muddy Waters. Or you may need to hear some Bird or some Coltrane or Mary Lou Williams or Ella Fitzgerald. Or I can tell by this room, you may need to hear some Tupac or Biggie Smalls or, right, 50 Cent or somebody like that. Right? But we go through things in our life where we use music as a soundtrack to what's going on. But what if you flipped that? What if music became the foreground and not the background? See, I believe that you can tell the history of any time, place, or moment in history via music. So if you want to learn what happened in 1967, you can do a number of things. One is you can go through every book that was written about the time and the moment that you're looking for, encyclopedias, dictionaries, compendiums, etc., 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 and read what happened. Or you can collect as much music that was created during that time or about that time, across the genres, across all the things that we use to, you know, separate one another, and hear firsthand accounts, objective opinions, what happened. I would argue that the music tells the better story. Music is important. It's really important. Part of the challenge of today's time and the whole 21st century is that we diminish the importance of music. Music becomes first a source of entertainment. It becomes something that we use for a transcendental experience as opposed to being an intent experience. We use music to take our minds off of something as opposed to use music to put our minds on something. And when we do that, we minimize and we really disregard the message in music. See, here's what's beautiful about music as a tool for bridging the generational divide. Many folks in a certain generation love the Beatles. Many children of those folks grow up not so necessarily loving the Beatles. But then one thing happens when they get to college. All of a sudden, the folks who grew up not so necessarily loving the Beatles automatically love the Beatles. And it's something I can't explain. I don't know why that happens. But somehow, in our kind of youth rebellion and revolting mode, we just decide not to like anything that represents the previous generation. We don't want to dress like them. We don't want to look like them. We don't want to talk like them. We don't want to smell like them. Thus, the fragrance and perfume companies make money upon money upon money. But something happens when we reach a moment of coming into our own adulthood. We begin to explore the relevance, the importance, and I would argue the message of that quote-unquote stuff. And then we take it upon ourselves. What am I getting at? I'm getting at this. Jazz in many ways exemplifies what I've just been talking about. Jazz allows us to see where we've been, be where we are, and almost in a strange way, see where we're going. And what am I saying? I'm saying that it's amazing that somebody like Al Vega, who has been a phenomenal musician for a number of years, is as contemporary as he is traditional. But what am I saying? I'm saying that it's almost ironic that as old as jazz is as an expression, many of the elders or originators or forefathers and foremothers of jazz are as contemporary as some of the younger artists today. I mean, if you need to walk with me, take a look at Satchmo, Louis Armstrong. Go all the way back to the beginning of the century. I guarantee you that no trumpet player today, no trumpeter today, can get Armstrong's sound. I'm not talking about what he played. I'm not even talking about how he played. But there's something so powerful and potent about the sound that he had that you can't grasp. But what is it about his sound? Well, it's about the fact that jazz exemplifies the notion of utilizing your life experience to say something. You may say the blues did that before and spirituals did that as well. Well, jazz exemplifies that because it takes both of those to the next level. Whereas the spirituals were a body of work that dealt with an African-American or a black experience during slavery, jazz looks at the United States experience at a number of continuum time. How do we deal with race? It's all in jazz. How do we deal with age? It's all in jazz. How do we deal with ethnicity? It's all in jazz. How do we deal with all of the things that distinguish and separate us? It's all in jazz. See, it's not necessarily in the spirituals. And if you're honest about it, it's not really in the blues either. Because if you're really, really honest about it, the blues, until the 1950s, late 40s, early 50s, was all black. And then somehow in the late 40s, early 50s, it becomes somehow all white. Now, somebody missed, you know how the railroad crossing guard has a lever and put it down, everybody goes that way. But what's interesting about this is the blues is about expression from a certain perspective in its origination. And somehow that expression gets either deviated, translated differently, perhaps appropriated differently, or some change happens to where a whole body of people feel like that expression is no longer useful for this population and move on. That really hasn't happened to jazz. See, what happens is if you look at this chronicle of black music in the United States, it's always changing because the expression and the needs and desires of the people who create it always change. And so in many ways, music for black population is about survival. It's really never been until the last 30, 40, 50 years about economic gain, about, social mobility. It really hasn't been about that. It's been about the fact that this population of people has no social access, no political rights, no economic opportunities, and thus utilize the music to say what we can't say through the vote. Utilize the music to say what we couldn't say through the protest, and utilize the music for this very functional and practical aspect. So in many ways, when you look at spirituals were about, look, we in this bad place right now. We need to get from here to there. So here's how we're going to do it. The blues is like, we're in a little bit better place than we were when we were singing that, but we still need to get somewhere else. And so this is what we're going to do to get from here to there. What's funny is people listen to the blues and think that blues is always about my baby that left me. I don't know what I'm going to do. But that was rarely what the blues was about. We understand about coded language and double entendre and all of these different literary devices, which continues to amaze me because in the historical record, it's often reported that the folks who created the blues in these early periods were not only illiterate, but perhaps unintelligent. Now, I think it's quite brilliant that these illiterate and unintelligent folks knew how to utilize double entendre and all of these coded devices. But I'll leave that for another lecture. What does jazz say about all that? Jazz says this, that you can have a musician like Charlie Yardbird Parker, who was considered one of the greatest bebop musicians of all time, but I would consider him a blues musician. Matter of fact, the majority of what Bird played was blues. He just played in a different way. So all of that music gets usurped into this big pool of music called jazz, which I would call an umbrella, even more than a genre. Spirituals. Coltrane was playing spirituals. Matter of fact, one of his popular tunes was called Spiritual. So it gets usurped in there. In many ways, jazz does this. Jazz shows us that music can really heal the world. Now you're saying, man, where'd you get that from? See, watch this. World War II. You have folks on the opposing sides of the war who would put their weapons down and go see people like Benny Carter play. Now look at this. During the day, trying to kill each other. But at night, you'd put your weapon down, go into a small, tight jazz club, and sit one table from the person who you were trying to kill, just to hear this little black dude play some music. And that's widely documented, that and other occurrences, that the music was so powerful that it allowed you to forget or temporarily yield from what your intentions were for that day and to deal with something greater. Okay, but maybe you don't see that. Well, watch this. Jazz, like spirituals and blues, goes international. But different from spirituals and blues, jazz becomes a voice of liberation for many people around the world. For people who didn't have the same experience as the folks in the United States who created jazz, but who saw the liberating power of jazz and began to appropriate, if not use, the expression in their own nationhoods. So that jazz becomes a voice for freedom, for equality, for justice all over the world. But we missed it because we're so intent on claiming that we discovered it and that we own it. So you can't be an authentic jazz musician if you're in Japan because jazz was created here. Or maybe you missed that one too. Imagine this. Somebody like John Coltrane, 1964, A Love Supreme. Tremendous work. Magnum opus. Tremendous album. Great musicians. That album goes around the world. And it speaks to people who are Buddhists, who are Protestant, who are Jewish, who are Hindu, who are every belief under the sun, including people who claim they have no belief. And is it what John Coltrane said? Well, I really doubt it because the only thing that was in there, a love supreme, a love supreme. Allah. And some would argue that it actually says Allah Supreme, Allah Supreme. But those are some of the conversations we have in the intellectual academic world. Regardless of what you think it says, those are really the only lyrics on the album. Something central about that album, though, is that it spoke to the hearts and minds of people all over the world. Let me move on. Jazz is really one of the first moments in history where the music, and I said this about Al Vega earlier, is both traditional and contemporary at the same time. The spirituals always were and always will be the spirituals. Anytime you hear a spiritual, you automatically transcend back to that moment in history, that moment in time, and you're being nostalgic in many ways. The language is different. It's not contemporary. The aesthetic and the mood is different. It's not contemporary. Everything about the spirituals say we're going back to traditional time, and we need to, for posterity's sake, remind ourselves and teach our younger people about the rich tradition and heritage of the spiritual. The blues, even though there are folks creating new blues today, and they sound great, they're still based on an old aesthetic. The blues. I mean, you know, B.B. King is playing the mess out of the guitar. There's no question about that. And he's not the only blues musician, but if you look at B.B. King, he still reminds you of this legacy and this tradition here. And there are other musicians, clearly contemporary musicians, numerous of them, but still that tradition is locked in here. But jazz takes us on a trip that many of us still can't swallow. Because we get to the whole debate about whether bebop is real jazz or not. We get to the whole debate about free jazz or avant-garde or out music. Is that real authentic jazz or not? Or can the musicians really play or not? And then, oh my goodness, don't go past 1968. Oh my God, don't do it. Because we know that there was no new jazz post-1968. I mean, jazz rock fusion, oh, you know, young kids doing that mess. And then, oh my goodness, not the merging of jazz and R&B or easy listening music, aka smooth jazz. Oh, dare us not say anything about that. And then if you can even get to the next level and talk about the merging of jazz and hip hop, oh my goodness, is that even real? Jazz is still current. It's still moving along. And it's always borrowed and taken bites of and merged and joined with the going thing. Even back to Jelly Roll Morton and the whole notion of that Latin Caribbean feel. The Haberna and all of that Caribbean thing that he was doing, right? And the emerging of Latin jazz, which some would say comes in the 60s. No. If you look at New Orleans as one of the most liberal cities and ports, you had an influx of all kind of cultural traditions in that area. So you had a mixture emerging of all kind of things there going on there, right? And then you look at bebop and some of the Cuban musicians and Dizzy Gillespie and his friends who were coming in doing the percussion stuff. Oh, my goodness. So jazz has always merged and synthesized with other things, right? So it's no different in the 1970s. And, of course, if we say that Miles Davis was one of the leaders of the jazz rock fusion, period, with the album Bitches Brew, then all of a sudden it legitimizes it, right? I mean, dare we say Miles Davis was one of the originators of the jazz and hip-hop thing, right, with Doo-Bop? Anybody remember that album? The DJ on there? Oh, yeah. See, what's interesting about this is that if we see jazz for what it is, it'll help bridge the generational divide. Because when we look at jazz and jazz musicians, we see these pictures of these older musicians. We see pictures of Louis Armstrong when he was, you know, a little up in age, not realizing that he began playing professionally in the streets of New Orleans like at 8, 9, 10, 11. I mean, we see pictures of Miles Davis as an older gentleman, not realizing that he got his start at like 16, 17. I mean, like at 17, he was playing with Billy Eckstine. Guess who else was in the band? Bird and Diz. 17? Wow. Can you imagine? Now, Davis was born in the early 20s. So by 1949, matter of fact, he was born in 1926. 1949, when he made that legendary album, Birth of the Cool. Remember 1949, Capitol Records? He was 23. A baby. That's one of the greatest albums of all time. What about Coltrane? 59, right? Sheets of Sound, right? Giant Steps. Right? Everybody knows Giant Steps solo, right? He was 23. Wow. Ella Fitzgerald. the big first showcase at the Apollo Theater? 17. Ah. Now, if that got out, then we changed the perspective of what jazz is. It ironically is about young people expressing themselves. Oh my goodness, I done messed up the whole historical chronicle of jazz already. Because if it's about young people, then somehow jazz can't just be about the music of those older people. It becomes an expression that's girded and grounded in the young people's experience and their desire to push the envelope and express themselves in as real and true a way as they can. Oh, it's not just about these older musicians jamming and being nostalgic and talking about how life used to be when they had to walk 3 miles to school and back and get up at 4:30 in the morning to tend the fields and all these stories. You mean Louis Armstrong was a teenager? You mean Mary Lou Williams was 14? Married at 17 and was touring the country as a composer and arranger at 17? Oh my goodness. That messes up the whole story. But no, it fixes the story. Because it doesn't create this delineation that jazz is an old-timer sport, if you will. And more importantly, what it does is this. It allows us to understand that in many ways, jazz could have been seen as a culture or a subculture by some young musicians who every generation perhaps became younger and such that the young people of the 40s were in a way trying to create their own voice from the young people of the 30s. And the young people of the 50s were trying to create their own voice different from the people of the 40s. And if you look at it that way, then that's why it makes sense that every decade jazz changes. I mean, because clearly you have New Orleans stuff in the 19 to 19 teens, and then it goes to Chicago, and it goes to New York, and by the time of the Harlem Renaissance, 1917 to 1932 or something, you have New York and big band jazz, and all of a sudden you go from the jazz era to the swing era, right? And then from the swing era to this thing called bebop, which was revolutionary, right? 1940s. And then 1940s, you get this kind of split in jazz where it goes West Coast, attached to the motion picture industry, where you have cool jazz and third string jazz, where jazz is associated with motion pictures who have sound now, need some musical soundtrack and backdrop. But then also on the East Coast, you have this hard bop thing where musicians were trying to reincorporate the African-American or black folk tradition within jazz. So you get the B3 organ coming into jazz in the 1950s. You get smaller groups that are reutilizing blues and all kind of traditional sounds. And then the 1960s, oh, the angry, turbulent 1960s, where you have avant-garde or out jazz or free jazz, which leads into 1970s, where you have jazz rock fusion or the fusion between jazz and rock, which leads into the 1980s, where you have jazz and R&B or jazz and easy listening music or smooth jazz, which leads us into the 1990s, where you have jazz and hip hop merging. Groups like The Roots, groups like, MC Solar and Guru, right? Even Branford Marsalis and his group Buckshot LaFunk. Which leads us into the 2000s. Where are we now? If jazz changes every decade, where are we now? So jazz is traditional and it's contemporary at the same time. Because in many ways, we still haven't figured out what Louis Armstrong was really saying. I mean, he asked the immortal question, what did I do to be so black and blue? And I'm not sure we had the answer to that. But maybe say the 25th century statement, maybe we'll get it by then. John Coltrane asked the question, what is or who is or why is a love supreme? I'm not sure we got there yet. These statements, these musical musings, are way beyond where we are. We still haven't wrapped our fingers around what Thelonious Monk was doing. We get so bogged down by how he was doing it that we just consider him crazy. And we have a difficult time calling him a genius because he was so unorthodox. But the simple fact is, we still don't understand what you're saying. All the greats. See, jazz helps us to deal with that. It helps us to deal with racism in this country. Because you can't deal with jazz without talking about all of the rippling rows and the tides, the turbulent waves that happen in society. That's why we talk about Benny Goodman and him, quote unquote, integrating jazz, right? Quote unquote, right? We talk about all the great jazz musicians and who should really be the king of jazz, who should really be the king of swing. Well, you have to talk about those things. And when you talk about them, you realize that part of the essence of the music is communicating and expressing those things. Because it's not just a black thing. It's not just a white thing. I mean, geez, we're using color TV, right? So you can't just make things black and white. It's an us thing. It's a we thing. And jazz helps us to explore that. Jazz helps us to deal with gender situations. The majority of jazz texts are still from a male chauvinistic perspective. We still write women out of history. You get Mary Lou Williams, you get Lil Harding Armstrong, and then you get the singers. And then you may get a paragraph, if not a page, about the International Sweethearts of Rhythm. But there were other female musicians who were tremendous. They may have not recorded, but they were the teachers, they were the leaders, they were the influencers. They were the ones who really made a difference in the community. That story needs to be told. We're still wrestling with that because it's real life, and jazz exemplifies that. It helps us to deal with class situations. It helps us to deal with economics. It really brings all of this stuff forefront, because if you really deal with the messages in the music, you can't ignore them. You can't ignore them. Which brings me to the epilogue, hip-hop. Let's imagine, for the moment, that you take your own personal conception of what hip-hop is, put it in your hand, and stick it in your pocket. Let me paint a different picture for you. Because I will be the first to admit, I will be the first to recognize, and I'll be the first to articulate that there are many things that are not so good about hip-hop and hip-hop culture. So let me put that on the table. I'm not trying to sway you or convince you or justify or rationalize. But what I want to show you is this. That during a period where young people felt disenfranchised, they felt ostracized, they felt left behind, they felt forgotten, they felt like nobody had their best interests. And then they saw one another killing each other in the streets. Gang violence, gang warfare, turf battles, turf warfare. And they began to use the dynamics of self-determination to create a better existence for themselves. So they took pre-existing expressions. Folks have been emceeing or rapping or, you know, talking with a beat over a rhythm for a long time. So they didn't invent it, but they utilized that expression. And they matched that and merged it with these young people who were utilizing records and record players to do some unique things on the turntable. Nothing new, but a new creative, innovative use of it. And they put those things together. And then, now, you know, folks have been dancing since the Old Testament. So they took these dance styles and they merged that with this new thing they were putting in. Folks have been using slang for so long. So they took some new slang words and merged that here. And then, as I said before, every generation wants to express themselves or look different from past generations. So they created a new look and they merged that. I would even argue that many of us, although we would articulate it as a legacy, want people to know that we were here. So we don't necessarily write on the walls to say that I was here. But we understand the concept. So they took that and merged together. and created this expression that dealt with their youth, them being young, but more importantly, them feeling like their voice was ripped away from them, that they had no opportunity to express themselves of who they were. Now you got to walk with me here, because if you can't see that, I got to give you more backdrop. We're in the boroughs of New York, Bronx, Brooklyn, Harlem. Let's take Bronx, for example. Anybody ever been on the Bronx Parkway? Anybody travel up that? I remember when it wasn't there. I'm just messing with you there. But before that existed, that was our residential area. And in order to allow a thoroughway for the folks who worked in the city, Manhattan, and who commuted from outside the city, they created the Cross Bronx Parkway. And of course, you have to rip up residential area in order to put the parkway there. And so as they ripped up the area, constructed the parkway, that area, Bronx, which was actually a nice neighborhood, which actually has a rich history, became dilapidated. And as neighborhoods dilapidate, those who have move. Those who have not, get stuck. And then you may remember the news clippings of all the arson and all of the insurance fraud claims and even the presidential visits that suggested that this was the worst neighborhood in the country. All the while, we're cleaning up Manhattan because of the international tourism. So if you were a young person who has seen mom or dad or grandma or grandpa work 40 years towards retirement and they get sucked out 3 days before they can claim, or you see them having rented this apartment building for the last 50 years and it was part of the family. Now the apartment building is not worth anything, so the landowner leaves it there and falls into bad shape. Or the best teachers on one day leave your school and your school system and your school district. As a kid, how do you feel? Now mom and dad have to work 2, 3, 4 jobs, no longer there. They have the whole latchkey syndrome. And then gangs take on the family structure, become the community that previously was and no longer exists. And now this new culture, subculture called hip-hop, which, you know, wasn't really called hip-hop in the beginning, but later on became that, becomes the dominant structure for these young people who are fending for their lives, struggling to create their own existence, and most importantly, just simply want their voice to be heard. See, that's hip-hop culture. That's hip-hop culture. Not all of this stuff that we look at now, the bling-bling and, you know, fine cars and all that, you know, instant gratification stuff. I'm painting two different pictures. If we want to be honest about it, you can't blame the kids for this stuff either, because it was somebody upstairs in the corporate world made this accessible and make it happen. But that's a different lecture too. All I'm simply suggesting is that hip hop, like jazz, allows folks to find their voice and express themselves in the rawest and truest sense. Hip hop, like jazz, allows one to feel important, even to a small group of people, but also allows them to feel like they have, in a sense, the right to say what they have to say. Hip hop, like jazz, gives one the notion of being traditional and contemporary at the same time. Hip hop, like jazz, has taken the world by storm. And in most, if not all, nations, hip hop resides in some shape, form, or fashion. Hip hop, like jazz, has become the voice of liberation for folks outside the United States. So you have folks in third world or quote-unquote third world countries who utilize hip-hop to express their desires for freedom, express their desires for justice, express their desires for equality. You have hip-hop being utilized by people all over the world to express their need for being heard. Hip-hop, like jazz, utilizes the basic value that music is important, that music can bridge the generational divide, and that music is almost essential to our expression. Hip-hop, like jazz, matters in the 21st century. It matters. Take some questions here. Thank you. Mr. Rod Flakes. That's a great question. Actually, a great statement. I have a tendency to not define music. Let me give you my rationale behind that. Matter of fact, beyond not defining music, I have a tendency not to define genres either, because I don't believe that genres really exist in terms of 2x4 boxes that musicians or artists create to be contained within. I think that music is something very intimate and personal, and that what I may consider music, you may not. And in respect to that universal appeal, I have a tendency to not define music. Let me share with you some of the commonplace definitions and where I find problems in them, though. Because some people would say that music is organized sound. But many of us who listen to jazz, for instance, we would say that some of the most beautiful sound is not organized, right? When you take five musicians and you say, go for it, that's not necessarily organized. Right? And then if you look at jazz in the 1960s or free jazz or avant-garde, one of the premises of free jazz or avant-garde is to break some of the quote-unquote Western rules of music, to clearly go after them. And that's why many musicians decided in some of the groups and collectives to not have fine-tuned instruments like the piano, which is often tuned to A440, which is a Western tuning, right? So other aerophones and other instruments were able to play outside of the quote-unquote traditional tuning, whereas a piano, it takes a lot of work to do that. So we have these clear-cut definitions of music. Another one is the combination of rhythm, harmony, and melody. And although that may, you know, be true, and in a very abstract way, it probably perhaps always is true, depending on how you define those other terms, but it doesn't have to be. So in my conception, a baby crying is music. Or is music. A bird singing outside is music. One of the great musicians, Eric Dolphy, when he was in Los Angeles, used to go outside and sing with his flute to the birds. And he's one of few musicians who's been able to have a conversation with a bird via the flute, because the flute timbre is very different from the bird's timbre. So you really got to know what you're doing in order to get the bird's attention, first of all. And how we intellectualize that is beyond me. But in order to have that conversation, right? So the notion of what is music is a very difficult conversation to have. I would simply say that music in many ways is expression and communication, utilizing the presence or lack of presence of sound. That's how I would define it if I had to. Great question. You guys are being shy. Yes, sir. That's a great question. One of the challenges is that hip-hop is so new. You really only have about a 30-year, you know, give or take a few years, time span. And in academic settings, it's almost too new. I mean, in academic settings, we really just started teaching about rock, right, which is about 50, you know, plus or minus, you know, years old. So we have really just begun dabbling in hip-hop, quote-unquote, studies over the last 10 years. I think there will be a collection of key recordings. Will they be released in a format as a Smithsonian Collection of Jazz? I don't think so. Because one of the major differences in the recording industry and the entertainment industry in the last 34 or 35 years is the fact that recording companies have gained so much power that it may not be in their interest to license or allow permission to have a recording from Sony, a recording from Universal, a recording from Warner, a recording from Koch to be on one compilation, because in theory, their perception would be that they would lose money. So there may be, and there actually are, a number of hip-hop playlists that are on iTunes or Rhapsody or Zune or some of the, you know, downloaded musical things that are done by music fans, not necessarily by academicians, or folks who, you know, study the music or whatnot. I think it's a great question. I don't know. Yes, Don. Sure, there are numbers. The Roots, which is a group that is highly popular on most college campuses, is a group that performs live. So the drummer, Questlove, Amir Thompson, is a musician who has played both in the hip-hop realm, but also in the jazz realm, with Uri Kane and bass player is going to come to me shortly. I think they're called the Philadelphia Experiment. I think that's the name of it. Christian McBride. And there are numerous other artists. For instance, I mentioned Guru and his producer, Solar, who have utilized jazz and really made hip-hop or rap songs about jazz historiography and the presence of jazz musicians all along. Branford Marsalis is one with Buckshot LaFunk, who had a group where he utilized jazz expression merged with hip-hop, you know, turntablists and whatnot. Of course, we go back to the 1970s with Herbie Hancock and his revolutionary recording Rocket, right, which was one of the first videos on MTV, right? And so the question is Herbie Hancock a jazz musician, or is he a musician who happens to play jazz most of the time but has done this one as just a little experiment? You know, we get into all those questions, but that's an early one. Again, Miles Davis and Doo-Bop, you know, with the turntablist on one of his last, you know, albums before he passed away. There are, a lot of musicians now clearly acknowledge the presence of jazz in their work. Of course, they have to for licensing reasons and copyright infringement lawsuits. But most hip-hop artists would openly and clearly acknowledge the influence of jazz music on their ability to create. And the use, for instance, for breakbeats. I mean, you know, some of Buhana, you know, Art Blakey's drum fills have been the source material for tremendous, hip-hop samples. But I think there are numerous artists. Matter of fact, there is a collection of CDs from Hidden Beach Records called Hidden Beach Presents, where you have musicians are doing hip-hop, quote-unquote, standards, if you will, as instrumental jazz selections. So they'll play a hip-hop song that you may have heard on the radio with, you know, Jerry Allen on piano and, you know, numerous other phenomenal jazz musicians. So this thing is mutually beneficial, if you will, where the jazz musicians are utilizing the hip-hop expression in their works as well. Great question. Any other questions? Yes, another one. Please. Yes. That's a great question. I think it's possible, but I think it won't necessarily happen that way. I think the majority of our jazz venues have gone away from the ballroom type settings and the open forum venues where you can actually find the dance floor. So if you think about the major venues in Boston, you really don't have space to dance unless you utilize a space that's probably not for dancing, and then the whole notion of looking, quote unquote, out of place. So there is this aesthetic notion in terms of how venues and how performance spaces have almost, consequently removed the dancing aspect away from jazz, because jazz was about dancing. You're absolutely right about that. And hip hop is about dancing. And the similar situation will not happen with hip hop just because of the spatial demands of hip hop and because of the youthfulness of the young people who go to these concerts. They don't care. They'll stand in the seats and dance. We won't. And so there's a dynamic tension that I don't want to say is relative to generation or age, but it may be relative to something else. I just don't have the term for it at the moment. But yeah, at some point, it will be important to recognize that jazz was and is about dancing. And here's another perspective on that. The reason why musicians, and I'm thinking of Keith Jarrett, is one of my favorites. Now, Keith will get into playing his instrument, and his leg will be hitched up, and he'll be leaning over in the piano and almost looking like he's, you know, about to just blow up within himself. And part of the notion is that jazz is about an embodiment. And what many people call dance, I like to call embodiment. Because often when we talk about dance, we think about moves. So there is this dance, this dance, this dance. But when you embody something, you know, just like I'm speaking now and I just can't stand still because I'm so passionate about what I'm talking about, I'm embodying what I'm saying. And so in my conception, I'm dancing. So as a musician, as I'm playing, I'm really getting into it, I'm dancing. So interestingly enough, it's the audience who's missing out because the musicians are dancing. As a matter of fact, many of us have probably seen these Thelonious Monk clips where he'd be performing and then he'd just get up and, you know, do his thing, right? And then he'll jump back on the piano and hasn't missed a beat and it seems so perfectly choreographed. But the notion is the embodiment is dancing. So in many ways, perhaps the audience does dance in just a more subtle way. You know, we do this and we do this and do this and some of us who want to be regal, you know, we may do our knee like this. Nobody can see it in here. You know, so there is this notion of embodiment. But you're right. It's not back to the dance moves that used to go along with certain, you know, sounds or styles of music. Great question. Yes, sir. Please. That's a great question and a tremendous theory. And in practicality, I almost see it the other way. Tree can only expand as far as the roots expand. So the great oak trees and great maple trees that grow high and wide, their roots go deep and long. What happens to roots, and I like your analogy and I want to use it for a little bit, is that roots become invisible. And roots go down so deep and so long that we have a tendency not to really know where they are and where their endings are. And somehow the roots are finding nourishment and finding all the nutrients and resources that's needed for the branches and the leaves to continue to grow and shoot. So in many ways, let me give you an interesting scenario. The roots, another contemporary group that I mentioned earlier, this kind of combination of jazz and hip-hop, they're touring now, and I saw them a few weeks ago, and believe it or not, they have a tuba player. Now, this is a jazz hip-hop group but they're touring with a tuba player. Now, ironically, the tuba player plays the bass lines. Now, there clearly is an electric bass player, as we would imagine. But the tuba player, in addition to playing the bass lines, is doing some of the traditional marching band steps, okay? And dancing in the contemporary stuff all at the same time. Now, here's the connection, the teaching point. Since I know that my college students love the Roots, and since I know that anytime the Roots are in town, they're going to go see them, and I've done my homework already, I'm going to engage in a conversation. What was up with the tuba player? And ironically, they've already gone to Google, Wikipedia, and they can explain to me the presence of tuba in jazz going back to the early New Orleans period. Now, the extension of that is, how do we get those young people who now have a sensibility of that history into the clubs or the venues to see the authentic music played? That's where I join you in one of my frustrations, because we have a tendency to be so contemporary that we don't make the connections. And my thing is, in order for us to be more contemporary, we have to have more connections to the past. And so there are numerous things that we can do in order to reconnect our young people with that rich tradition, because I think it's necessary. As a matter of fact, it's essential, because you can't have new growth without new growth in the roots. So we have to figure out how to make that connection. In theory, we do it a number of ways. There are numerous lectures as this where we have, and I think Jazz Boston was phenomenally brave and brilliant in making this connection between hip-hop and jazz, because essentially what we're trying to do is exactly what you're saying. How do you make the connection with where the young people are today to where the music really started, right? And I really appreciate the way that you said it in terms of the beginnings of, you know, American music. I think you're right in that term. And so there is a rich tradition there that needs to be illuminated, and the spotlight really has to be put on there, but not necessarily for nostalgic sake, but for these connections. And sometimes the connections don't go exactly where we want them to go or in the fashion that we want them to look like. So this tuba player in this phenomenally successful and highly visible group may be that connection that allows for this traditional and very important innovative music from that period to be highlighted, be spotlighted. Hope I've addressed the theoretical basis of the question. Great analogy thing. I have to take that on the road with me. Appreciate that. Any other questions? Yes, sir. Yes, sir. It's a great question. I start the question based on the premise that we live in the information overload generation, or the information overload time or era. So the challenge behind that is that too much, too fast creates a blur. And so when you have all of this information that's widely and easily accessible, it becomes a blur, and it almost becomes minimized in terms of its importance. And so in many ways, the challenge is, how do we encourage and empower folks to, one, have an awareness that it exists, and then encourage them to go seek it out. My first premise is always live is better. So that's why we need these groups, like the one that you're in, to be able to play this music so that we can send folks that direction to see it live and experience the beauty of it, to experience the communication and the essence of it, and then to continue to research about it. But when all this information is flying this way and this way, right, we can pull what we want to and then let the rest fly back, and we only have an excerpt of the real deal. And that's how many of the lives of these tremendous musicians, whose work we take for granted, that's how their lives have been minimized, because we take the work. Right? So we take the work of an artist and act like we know the artist, right? And we want to tell everybody about that artist as if we were sitting down eating dinner and having coffee for the last 3 weeks with that person on a daily basis, which we haven't. So we have this kind of quick familiarity and intimacy, superficial intimacy with folks. And I would caution us that that's part of the greatest challenge, because when we approach things that way, we miss the message. We miss the awareness that there's a message. Right? So for most of us who heard Coltrane's Alabama, well, it's Coltrane, so it has to be good, right? Yeah, his tone was good. Never making the connection that that was Dr. King's eulogy, the four girls who were killed in the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham, Alabama. See, you miss the message when stuff is flying over this way. So you're going to a person who was there. That's why the next session with May Arnett and Al Vega is so important, because these musicians were there. They were here. And so you could speak to them about what was really going on from their perspective of being an insider during that period. So I think there's a challenge there. And I think stuff is more accessible. That becomes a challenge as well. Because in many ways, you got to know what you're looking for in order to find it. And that's difficult. Great question. Yes, sir. Thank you. Thank you. That's a great question. You know, what's really interesting about your question is it gets more into demographics of the viewership of those shows than it really does about our necessarily passions of music, right? So for many of us who we love jazz. I mean, you know, hey, we here. It's, you know, Jazz Week, Jazz Boston. We love jazz, right? So there's a question here. Are we represented as a primary demographic for these shows? And I would challenge us to say, not really, you know. And as unfortunate as it is, and nobody likes to feel left out, but they don't care about what I think. And I would argue, even though it's a great question, that they don't care about what you think either, right? Because we don't fit that demographic. You know, and it's unfortunate. And I think in many ways that both shows could gain a lot by examining the influence of jazz and hip hop and other forms of music within the context of their shows. And hopefully, I'm not trying to start a letter writing campaign here, but maybe if we spoke up a little bit, we can maybe change the course of that a little bit. I'm not sure. You know, I haven't watched American. I usually watch like the last 2 weeks just to see the real good stuff, you know. And I haven't watched the Dancing with the Stars yet this season. Okay, I appreciate that. I'll take your recommendation. But it's a great question, though. Any other questions? Yes, sir. Oh, yeah. Well, that's a great question. I'm glad you asked that. I mean, listen. In Europe, first of all, when you are able to look in on something, you have a different level of appreciation with the intimacy of the situation. What I mean by that is this. If there was no oppression in the United States, we wouldn't have jazz. Matter of fact, we wouldn't have spirituals, blues, jazz, R&B, rock, you can list them, hip-hop, etc. So the presence of oppression creates the need for a response to that oppression in real time, in real space. Now, having said that, if you're in the UK or in Europe or wherever you are looking in on the situation, you're not necessarily considered an oppressor or a victim or anything. As a matter of fact, you can take the role of being the friend of whomever you desire. So in many ways, during the 1920s to the 1940s, you had more jazz musicians leaving the United States going to Europe. Why was that? Because Europeans treated these jazz musicians with respect as people. They gave them equal rights and equal opportunities, and they valued their expression. Whereas in the United States, we were dealing with the bitter clutch of racism and oppression and all kind of discrimination. So it said that you could be a great musician, but you better be great over there. As a matter of fact, we want you to record so we can cover your stuff and make money on our, right? And so we know that history. In the UK, it was a different scenario. Now, look at the byproduct of that. In this country, we call those musicians who left here for extended vacations expatriates. Over here, we call them heroes and legends. See, so it's that notion of treatment and humanity, and jazz makes you deal with that. I mean, one of the great stories that Pops or Satchmo or Louis Armstrong used to always tell was about his trips for the State Department as an ambassador of goodwill, and he would travel overseas, and you know how it is when you're a big celebrity and big shot, you end up in the royal palace, right? And so you come back here, and the debriefing happens. What did you see? Who did you talk to? Did you overhear any conversations? What's going to happen? You know, in that whole scenario. Whereas over here, you see it from the perspective of here's a great musician who we value. Let's raise a statue of Sidney Bechet, right? Let's, you know, honor such and such with a day of his or her own. So you see, and I'm a postage stamp collector. I love postage stamps. So you see more postage stamps acknowledging, you know, black musicians or jazz musicians, black, white, yellow, blue, brown, turquoise, fuchsia, magenta, over here than you do here. So it says something about where we are, and unfortunately, we don't like to talk like this, but who we are. So as an artist, if you can deal with the backlash, it almost made more sense to spend time. I mean, think about contemporary artists now. It's almost still true because you can release an album here. You'll tour for a year. You kind of disappear for the next 3 or 4 years. And then you come back and you release another album and you kind of disappear for another 3 or 4. Well, where are you? You're over here. So it's an interesting scenario that deals with the existence and the continual existence of prejudice and discrimination and what that means. I mean, if you think about the whole aesthetic of being a quote-unquote jazz musician, and I don't necessarily like the term because a lot of quote-unquote jazz musicians play other things than jazz. They're musicians, but for the conversation, think about the whole stereotype. You know, what does that profile look like? What does it mean? Is it as highly regarded as a concert musician or a classical You know, if you're a jazz composer versus a classical composer, what does that mean? Now, many people today still don't think that jazz composition exists because all you musicians do is get on the stage and play. Whereas a classical or concert composer, you know, goes through a systematic approach to composing and, you know, just, you know, where we go like this. All right, I want you to play. Ba-dee-ba-doo-ba-dee-ba. And then I want you to play. Ba-ba-ba-doo-ba. All right, here we go. Ba-dee-ba-doo-ba-doo-boo. Ba-ba-ba-da-ba. Right? And that's jazz composition. So there's this whole wide dynamic that goes wider and broader musicality of expression. It really gets down to the hardcore questions of who we are, you know, what do we believe? What are we going to do about it? And I think jazz forces us to deal with those questions. I hope I've addressed your question. It's a good one. Don. I'd agree with you. I mean, you know, clearly what happens with music that's created in this country, whether it's considered black music or African-American music, or whether it's considered music from different populations of people, but not, there is a liberating value, liberating power in the music. And there's also an accessibility and inclusivity within the music. And I clearly think that those characteristics are what makes it so powerful. Because even though we wouldn't argue that jazz was created from the black perspective or the black experience in the United States, that experience deals with relationships with other people, other races, other communities. And so in looking at those relationships, jazz is more a chronicle or a story of relationships than it is from one position or one suggested position. So when we look at it that way, there's something so liberating by the fact that you can have jazz musicians who are of various races, various ethnicities, various beliefs, various places in life, who can come on the stage and perform at the same place, at the same time, and speak the same language. And see, that's what I'm getting at in terms of jazz has the power to heal, because if they had a conversation outside of the venue about what I believe and what you believe, we may get into it. But on the stage, the mutual respect and commitment and integrity and dignity of the music is most important. So I may express myself from my viewpoint, and you may express yourself from your viewpoint, and I may rebut, and you may rebut my rebut, and I may come back after you, and the audience is going to say, "Whoa, that was the best trading fours I've ever seen in my life." And we will too, because the music takes our limited ability to speak to a higher level. Our vocabularies are so small, you really deal with it. Particularly those of us who are English by first language. Our vocabularies are so small. I mean, when you look at some of the older languages like your Latins and your Greeks and your Hebrews, I mean, the way that those verbs are conjugated and the numerous phrases and all of the different nuances of those languages, I mean, there are more words, more phrases, I mean, more of everything. And when you pair that up to English, it's like, no wonder we cuss. We've run out of ways to say what we need to say. But that shows the importance of music, because music, in my opinion, transcends all of those language barriers. Because there's something so special about the sweet sound of whatever is being played when your heart is in it, your passion is behind it. There's something so piercing about the anger that comes through when you're really hurt and you express that through your instrument. Those things are real. And no matter what language you speak, read, hear, feel, etc., you get that. Really get that. It's a great question. Any other questions? I'm having fun. Yes, please. Oh yeah. No, it's similar. I mean, we don't want to just glorify the good and leave the bad to the side. I mean, you had all of that in jazz too. It just was a different generation, different period, so you didn't have as much media captivation on that. But you know, I can tell stories, but I probably shouldn't. But you had all of that, you know, if you will, within the jazz period. And I think the difference is that during that period, let me say it a different way. Hip-hop culture and hip-hop, it's the first time, really, that adult content is marketed towards young people, right? Because it used to be, because that the raunchiness in the music is nothing new. I mean, you listen to some of the blues and the R&B and rock and roll from the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, and you have some really raunchy stuff. I mean, some really raunchy stuff. But all the kids knew that when that stuff came on, supposed to go to the other room because that was adult music, and you didn't have to have no sticker on it. It was just a known fact that there was a difference between kids music and kid appropriate stuff and adult music and adult appropriate stuff. As a matter of fact, if you were a kid, and I think this is across the community, so I'm not even going to suggest this is only happens in one community. There were certain conversations that as a kid you couldn't even partake in. There were adult conversation, and then there was conversation where you were asked your viewpoint. There were some times where there was, you know, times where you just weren't allowed even in the house, you know, go outside, right, while stuff happened in the house. And so somehow there's a breakdown when we get to the hip-hop period where adult content and adult-oriented stuff is marketed specifically towards kids. And so to me, that's the turning point. That's the problem right there. Because when you do that, there's some adult who's saying, yes, it's okay to put this in the hands of young people. See, in many ways, we want to hold the young people accountable, and I think we should. But they shouldn't get all the blame because there's somebody over here who allowed it to happen. And so in many ways, it happened in the jazz period. It was just seen as adult stuff. You know, people tell the stories of, you know, Charlie Parker and, you know, Bessie Smith and Lester Young and their narcotics addiction. You know, some of the musicians who actually had a lot of money and flaunted it and had nice cars, and, you know, stories about Cab Calloway and, you know, a whole host of musicians. And so that stuff existed. I think the difference is that now in a very highly EDIs and technical, you know, technologically savvy world, anything ends up on YouTube, right? And somebody's going to want to take advantage of that, take that for granted before the whole world sees. So I think that's the difference there. Any other questions? Yes, sir. Absolutely. Name is Emmett, E-M-M-E-T-T. Price, P-R-I-C-E. Reach me on the web by www.emmettprice.com. And you can reach me via email at e.price@neu.ed. N-E-U as in Nancy Edward. Northeastern University, yes. Yes. I'm sure you have tons of things to do. I will hang around if you want to make some personal comments or ask some more questions. Really enjoyed you Really appreciate you. Oh, yeah, why don't you come down? We can talk about that. How the funk emerged with jazz. Unless everybody wants to hear that. Everybody wants to hear that? Funk emerged with jazz. Well, interestingly enough, musicians are musicians, and we like to jam. So regardless of what genre or what style we perform in, we just like to jam. So interestingly enough, Miles Davis used to say one of his favorite musicians was this young guitarist by the name of Jimi Hendrix. And I'm not suggesting that Jimi Hendrix introduced, you know, funk into jazz, but what I am suggesting is that these cross-pollinations occur because of cross-influences via musicians who may play in different styles and whatnot. So when you look at, you know, Bitches Brew, which was a huge album, Miles Davis again, and his exploration of pushing the envelope and the dimensions of jazz further and wider, you have this incorporation of quote-unquote funk elements. And so that is kind of seen historically as one of the underpinnings of that incorporation. But that sound had been happening for years and years before by musicians just jamming. So what happens is musicians get in the room and an idea happens and we explore it, and then all of a sudden, you know, there's this little lick that's being played here and you're putting this on top of that or below that, and it happens. So in terms of the epicenter, there probably really is no dynamic epicenter of when it happens. The recorded happenings are probably Bitches Brew and subsequent albums, but I would argue that it happens by musicians just getting together and making music. Well, I wouldn't say that. I think funk has some aesthetic differences that go on, and it's a different approach to expression and communication. So it is another form of expression and communication. It is another medium and mechanism for expressing a message during that period. So it depends on who you're talking about now and from what frame of reference you're talking about. So it is a little bit different from just saying that it's improvisation. It does utilize improvisation, clearly. But there are some dynamic differences, if you will, in terms of philosophical approaches and sociological approaches to the music that make them different. Great question. Great question. Thank you. Thank you. Appreciate it.